So the theme that I gave for this this day was deconstructing Buddhism. The trouble is one gives these titles quite some time in advance, and one finds oneself in the grip of a particular enthusiasm at that point. And when the moment arrives, you wonder why you chose that title. Ian McEwan apparently once said that when you do a book tour, when he does book tours, he says he feels like the employee of a former self. Somehow beholden to promote a book that's already no longer part of his life. I don't feel quite that way, but and I am going to address that particular topic, but just to put that in mind. By deconstructing, I don't mean that either in the sense of the French philosophical school of Jacques Derrida and so on, with the déconstructionnisme. I'm using the word in a fairly loose sense. And I think that the meaning that it carries for me is to try to help in differentiating between what we might call Buddhism, on the one hand, and the Dharma, on the other. That what we encounter in our present time, particularly here in the West, is we find ourselves exposed to different forms of Buddhism. This, of course, is a very recent phenomenon in the history of the tradition, namely that one can live in a city like London, and within maybe a 2 or 3 mile radius, you can find a Buddhist temple or monastery or community of pretty much every historical variant of the Buddhist tradition. You'll find a Zen temple, a Theravada monastery, a Tibetan center, a Soka Gakkai chanting group. It's all available within a very small distance. Now, Buddhism did not grow up like that at all. There's something very peculiar about our current situation here in the West, particularly, where we are suddenly exposed to Buddhism in all of its diversity. And I think this is both, on the one hand, very enriching, because we're not, for example, if we'd grown up in Chiang Mai in Thailand, we would have pretty much only known of the kinds of Buddhism that were indigenous to Thailand, and perhaps even that region in Thailand. We wouldn't really have had any exposure whatsoever to anything else. Whereas today, particularly for those of us who are not born into a Buddhist family, and I suspect there's hardly anyone in this room who is probably Buddhist by birth, is there? Not a single one. And that, again, tells us something about the situation we're in. Our relationship to Buddhism is inevitably one that is not going to mirror very closely the relationship that a traditional Asian Buddhist would have to their church. Because effectively, in Asia, the temples, the monasteries function very much as the churches do here. So, on the one hand, this is very enriching because we can see this diversity, but at the same time, it's also very confusing. How do we choose or select a practice that's suited to ourselves? Some people are lucky and they fall in love with Tibetan Buddhism or Zen Buddhism and they feel utterly at home there. They find that teaching, that style of practice, entirely appropriate to their needs. They're the lucky ones. Many of us, and I include myself here, find that one might gain a great deal, say, from a Tibetan practice or Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, but at a certain point one might run into conflicts. One may not be entirely happy with the whole way that tradition expresses itself or imposes expectations on you. That you discover that beneath the surface of the Dharma teachings and the meditation practices, there are also systems of authority, of hierarchy, of power, which are inevitable in any human institution. But in this case, we often come across ways of exercising authority that do not fit so comfortably with a liberal, democratic society that we live in. Of course, you might have the same trouble if you were a Roman Catholic too, of course. But with Buddhism, there is often a strange sense of discomfort between what it is that intuitively draws you to the tradition and at the same time often elements that either strike one as alien or foreign or cultural and seem somehow to sort of get in the way a bit. I think it's quite common now over the last 20, 30 years for many of us who are practicing as Buddhists to spend time in different traditions. And so we, in my own case, I was, as Gary said, I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk and then I was a Zen Buddhist monk. And in recent years, the last, since I've been back in England really, since the mid-80s, my prime area of interest has been in the early Nikayas or the early canonical materials found in the Theravada school of Buddhism. But I'm not any more able to think of myself as either a Tibetan Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist, a Theravada Buddhist. None of those identities fit. And so I find myself asking, okay, well, what is it within this tradition that seems to speak so directly to my condition as a human being? What aspects of the Dharma really seem to support me in my life? And as a teacher, I find myself, and as a writer, constantly struggling to organize my understanding of this tradition in ways that speak to the condition of people living in 21st century Western Europe, or America, in my case. And so I've tried in my writing and so forth to put to one side the Asian traditions of Buddhism, respectfully. I'm not interested in criticizing them or trying to in any way disparage those schools of thought. But in putting aside those forms of Buddhism, I try, therefore, to get back to what might lie at the origins of the tradition, which I think it might be more helpful to speak of as the Dharma. So what I want to do this afternoon is reflect on what the Buddha meant by the Dharma. Perhaps the obvious point to begin is in the Buddha's own account of his awakening. And I'd like to read out a brief passage there. This is obviously for anyone who considers themselves a Buddhist or is drawn to the Buddhist tradition, what is crucial in defining oneself as a Buddhist is to have some understanding of what was crucial to Siddhartha Gautama's experience as the Buddha, as the awakened one. What was it that he woke up to? I prefer the word awakening to the rather more commonly used enlightenment, because it is simply closer to the sense of the Pali Sanskrit term. And it means that a very different metaphor is being utilized. Enlightenment employs the metaphor of light, that the Buddha's experience was in some ways similar to illuminating a light in a dark place, which is an expression you do find in the canon. But it's quite different to think of the Buddha's Bodhi awakening as similar to what it's like when you wake up in the morning. That seems to be the metaphor he chose. So in other words, what the Buddha experienced is something like what we experience when the alarm rings and we open our eyes and it's a new day. Awakening, waking up, is a waking up from either a deep state of unconscious sleep or a state of dreaming. And returning to a world that's no longer just your own subjective experience, as in a dream, but a world that is not under your own control, in which you are exposed to the world through the senses, in which you are part of a community, in which you are a participant with others in an unfolding reality called life. And when you wake up in the morning, that is the world in which you then find yourself and where you then live and act and think and behave. I'm going to give a lot of emphasis in this talk to the power of metaphor. That I think that what is, in a sense, very characteristic of the Buddha's genius is his use of metaphor and parable. And again, we could say the similar thing about much of the teaching of Jesus. So awakening is a metaphor. Enlightenment is a metaphor. Now, when the Buddha described his awakening, he spoke of his of having woken up to what he calls ida pachayata paticca samuppada, which translates as this conditionality, conditioned arising. I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but the key term is this term paticca samuppada, which means something coming into being out of circumstances and conditions. And he prefixes that with the expression ida pachayata. Ida is the common Sanskrit Pali word, which simply means this. In other words, the specific experience that's happening now. And the recognition that this is both the result or the consequence of what's occurred in the past, and it is the seed or it is the germ for what will follow in the future. The Buddha never spoke of his awakening in terms of having gained some kind of privileged insight into something like emptiness or the nature of reality or the Buddha nature or the true nature of mind. All of that came along quite a bit later. What is at the core of the Buddha's awakening is this waking up to the contingency, the conditionality of living processes. And I think the forms of meditation that he then presented, particularly the practice of mindfulness, is striking because it is a practice that, or a meditation, a spiritual practice, that attends to the phenomenal world. In Brahmanic tradition, the tradition the Buddha was in a sense rebelling against, the practice of yoga, the practice of tapas, of a spiritual discipline, is described as one of turning one's attention inwards into the deepest recesses of one's own self, one's Atman, one's soul, in order to recognize the intrinsic identity of your own inner essence with that of Brahman or God. The Buddha does a complete volte-face, a complete turning of attention in the opposite way. The Buddha presents his meditation, as I read out this morning, as sitting beneath a tree and noticing that you're breathing. And then this is extended to the rest of the sensations in the body, to becoming more attuned to your feelings, your thoughts, and then effectively to becoming totally present and open to whatever is appearing and passing away in the present moment. There's no sense at all here of trying to pierce through the veil of illusion, which is very much an idea from the Upanishads, but it's quite alien to early Buddhism. Later Buddhism, this sort of thinking comes back, with the positing of there being a kind of absolute or ultimate reality as opposed to the conventional or relative truths of this world. The Buddha never made that distinction. It's a later interpretative device, which is in some senses helpful, but I think it actually goes against, in a very significant way, the Buddha's awakening to the phenomenal world in which we live. So the Buddha describes this paticca-samuppada as the Dhamma. And there is an equivalence in his mind, therefore, that this Dhamma, what he's teaching, refers, in fact, perhaps is, the phenomenal world and our relationship to it. And this is, therefore, the place where we work, the place where our practice unfolds, the locus for the realization of value, whether ethical value or spiritual or religious value. It's going to happen here. It's going to happen in this world, in this moment. It's not going to happen anywhere else. And so there's a very marked emphasis in terms of his understanding of the Dhamma that it is here and now, that it is this experience that we need to look into and attend to and be with in a way that we can hopefully realize a more wise, compassionate, tolerant, open, loving relationship to life itself. And in fact, I would argue that we could possibly interpret paticca-samuppada, this rather jargon term, conditioned arising or dependent origination, I think is just a rather fancy way of saying life. The Buddha woke up to life, and that presented him with this clarified consciousness that one assumes that he experienced. The first encounter with life is dukkha. It's painful. This is not necessarily a happy and satisfactory place. And even if we experience well-being, which of course we do, and joy and happiness, we're also aware that that's not going to last, that it's going to change, that nothing remains fixed in this phenomenal, conditioned, contingent world. And in many ways, the Buddha's teaching is a way to come to terms with and to resolve one's conflicts with the condition in which one finds oneself at birth and will be evicted from at death. And that is the great challenge of the practice. Now, over the centuries, of course, Buddhism evolved in all sorts of wonderful ways. But almost invariably, because it had to somehow get these ideas across in a very different social, economic, political environment than that of 4th century BC India. So when Buddhism went to China or Japan or Korea or Tibet or Mongolia, it took a while, but eventually the Dharma was able to reconfigure itself in a way that was appropriate to those particular cultures and times. And that's pretty much what we inherit today. Our versions of the Dhamma, which we call Buddhism, that have survived in many cases for hundreds of years in particular Asian settings. Now, if we are to try to find out what an appropriate expression of this Dhamma might be for us today, then I think, again, we need to go back to the most reliable primary sources that we have. And those are found in the discourses, primarily, and the training texts of the what's called the Pali Canon, the collection of material attributed to the Buddha that's recorded in the Pali language. Now, again, Theravada Buddhism claims to represent the teachings of the Pali Canon. But I think there too, even though that is the case, the Theravada tradition is also a relative latecomer on the scene. Theravada Buddhism, as we know it now, was formulated in the 5th century AD by a man called Buddha Gosha in Sri Lanka. But that's 1,000 years after the Buddha. And there are elements, many elements, within Theravada Buddhism that do not go back to the historical Buddha, that are later philosophical, metaphysical ideas that grew up in the intervening centuries and eventually became the elements of the orthodoxy of a school called Theravada Buddhism. I'm interested in going back to the source texts of that tradition itself. And particularly, as I've already mentioned, I feel that by attending to some of the key metaphors that the Buddha uses, I think we might get quite close to a sense of how he saw himself and his teaching in his world. It has been argued by scholars, in this case Richard Gombrich has recently made this point, he's a professor of Sanskrit in Oxford, that the teachings that perhaps are most reliably attributable to Siddhartha Gautama would be the parables and the metaphors. I think similar things have been said about the teaching of Christ. The wonderful thing about parable and metaphor is that it exercises the imagination. If you look at how Buddhism develops, you find it becomes less metaphorical and more doctrinal. It becomes more philosophical, becomes more abstract. And abstract concepts are not things that greatly exercise the imagination. And in fact, I've seen criticisms of these early metaphors in that they're not clear enough. They don't have the clarity and the definition that a doctrine can aspire to. A metaphor is somewhat anarchic because it calls upon each of us to refer to our own experience of, let's say, waking up in the morning and imagining what the Buddha's teaching, or in what ways the Buddha's teaching is somehow comparable to that. We have to refer to our own immediate experience. I'm going to give you another metaphor here. This is the metaphor of the snake. And it's a passage we find in, for those of you who are interested, in Majjhima 22, the 22nd middle-length discourse. Suppose a man, the Buddha says, needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or tail. The snake would turn back on him and bite his hand or arm or one of his limbs, and because of that he would come to death or to some great suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So here too, some people learn the Dhamma, but having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with intelligence. They do not gain a reflective understanding of them. Instead, they learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others and winning in debates. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dhamma. These teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Now here the Buddha is comparing the Dhamma to a snake. Now, again, the metaphor is going to speak to each of us in a way that refers to our own experiences of snakes. I find snakes one of the most beautiful animals, but also one of the most frightening. I love the way the snake coils and moves with this extraordinary fluidity and suppleness and speed and vitality. But I'm also very wary of getting close to it. And again, we're aware that if you do deal with a snake, if you have a snake in your backyard and you need to get it out of your backyard, you need to pick it up in a way that will not cause you harm. Now, the analogy here says if you pick it up by the tail or you pick it up by its coils, in other words, by its body, the snake will come round and bite you. You have, therefore, to learn how to apprehend this creature in the way that will disable it, in a sense, if you're going to pick it up. And that means you have to pick it up by behind the head. So what's going on here, I think, is the Buddha's pointing out that his teaching is in some way rather treacherous. That if you get what he's saying in the wrong way, if you misapprehend it, if you grasp it incorrectly, it will actually serve not to benefit you, but to cause you harm. Now, the harm that for which he gives an example, is he says that instead, people who don't apprehend the Dharma as he intended, and they will learn it only for the sake of criticizing others and winning in debates. Now, I think nowadays we might understand that to mean to turn the Dharma into a set of opinions and views and beliefs. To think that what the Buddha was doing was presenting us with a kind of theory, a metaphysics, something that is composed primarily of ideas and concepts and views that we can then become rather attached to, perhaps rather identified with, and we can use the Dhamma as something basically to reinforce our sense of being a separate me. It could actually encourage, or it could contribute to a kind of egotistic self-importance or a conviction in being right where others are wrong. In other words, it becomes a prop for the very thing that the Buddha sought to dismantle, namely this fixed sense of a permanent ego. And I think we're all prone to this, and I'm certainly prone to it myself, if I'm quite frank. That as a Buddhist intellectual, I notice there is a great danger that I get too identified with the ideas. And I don't really notice that sometimes until somebody challenges me or somebody says something I really don't agree with. And I can actually feel it sort of coming up in my chest, this kind of, you know, this minor sort of, the Buddhist equivalent of road rage. Dharma rage. And then I have to acknowledge that I'm holding on to something a little bit too strongly. And it's a good warning signal. But unfortunately, I think many forms of Buddhism, which are basically orthodoxies, are rather prone even more to a conviction that that particular version of what the Dharma is right, and other versions are somehow probably not right. So in other words, the Buddha does seem to be warning us here against treating his teaching as a doctrine or a theory or as a metaphysics, which one can then identify with in calling oneself a Buddhist. Now another example, which again is a parable, and again uses an animal, and again seems to be making the same point. Now this is the parable of the elephant. At one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati at the Jetta's Grove in Anathapindika's monastery. At that time there were a number of recluses and Brahmins living around the city, and they were of various views, of various opinions, of various beliefs. There were some who asserted and held this view: the world is eternal, only this is true, any other view is false. And there were some who asserted this view: the world is not eternal. And then he gives a whole long list. The world is finite. The world is infinite. The soul and the body are the same. The soul and the body are different. After death, one exists. After death, one does not exist. And they lived quarrelsome, disputatious and wrangling, wounding each other with verbal darts, saying, the Dharma is like this. The Dharma is not like that. The Dharma is not like this. The Dharma is like that. This was reported to the Buddha. And he said, these people are blind. They do not know what is beneficial and what is harmful. They do not know what is Dhamma, and they do not know what is not Dhamma. Formerly monks, there was a certain king in this very city of Sarvati. And the king addressed one of his men and said, come now, bring together all those persons in Sarvati who have been blind from birth. Yes, your majesty, the man replied, and after detaining all the blind people, brought them to the king. Now, my man, said the king, show the blind people an elephant. Very well, your majesty. And he presented an elephant to the blind people, saying, this, blind people, is an elephant. To some of the blind people, he presented the head, to some the ear, a tusk, the trunk, the body, the leg, the hindquarters, the tail, the tuft at the end of the tail, saying, this is an elephant. Then the king approached the blind people and said, tell me, blind people, what is an elephant like? And those blind people who had been shown the head replied, oh, an elephant's just like a water jar. To those who had just shown the tusk, they say, this is just like a winnowing basket, a plowshare, a plow pole, a storeroom, a post, a mortar, a pestle, a broom. Saying, an elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that. They fought each other with their fists. And the king was delighted with the spectacle. Now, I'm sure you're familiar, most of you, I suspect, are familiar with the image. It's actually a very famous image. And I think it's even used elsewhere in Indian tradition. But what's striking, I think, is the context in which the Buddha presents this image. He compares his Dharma to an elephant in the same way as before he compared it to a snake. Now, I think the fact of choosing a wild animal, an animal that all of us would be, or at least people in India would be familiar with, is pointing, I think, to the fact that how the Dharma is actually a living thing. It's like an animal. It has its own vitality, its own autonomy, its own complexity. And it lives and it breathes and it does things. It's active, it's dynamic. Which is the very opposite to, let's say, a theory or a metaphysic or a doctrine or an opinion. Things which exist really only in the human mind and do not have any intrinsic vitality to them at all. They may be helpful, they may be useful, but they can also just as well become opinions and traps and fixed views, things to which we become obsessed and rather attached to. Now, when the Buddha gives the opening passage here, he compares the people who hold on to such metaphysical views to blind people who are exposed to a particular part of an elephant and then assume that the elephant must be the particular bit that they have had contact with. So the point, I think, here is that the Dhamma is too complex, it's too vital, it's too much of a living organism to ever be reduced to any one of its particular bits. And I think, again, there's a constant tendency to do this. I feel it's true of the term mindfulness, for example. Buddhism gets reduced to the practice of mindfulness and tends then to overlook the ethical dimension, perhaps the philosophical implications, maybe a social awareness. Because we've sort of come to say, well, this is what it really is. This is the highest teaching of the Dhamma, the practice of awareness and mindfulness. Failing, therefore, to see the overall complexity of what is going on, the Dhamma is, in fact, the whole elephant, the whole thing. Something very difficult to describe, something very difficult to really apprehend in its totality, unless we interact with it in a certain way. Our intellect alone will not be able to capture what an elephant is. We need to observe it, we need to listen to it, we need to maybe have physical contact with it, we need to see how it behaves, see what it does, see where it lives. And only through this rather complex relationship can we begin to get a sense of the elephant. And there's possibly something about the elephant that will always evade our capacity to really grasp or understand. So going back to the Dhamma, the Dhamma the Buddha describes when he recalls his own awakening, he says, is this endless process of rising and passing away out of conditions, which I've suggested might be a metaphor for life itself. And then when he speaks of the Dhamma in these two elements, he likewise evokes a living creature, a snake or an elephant, to try to sort of get to the same point. Now, I think it's useful, I found it useful, to come back to these primary metaphors, not just because they're rather useful teaching devices, but because they are suggestive, I feel, of the Buddha's sensibility and perspective on things. Some of you are no doubt familiar also with the metaphor of the arrow, where a person has been shot by a poisoned arrow, is lying on the ground, bleeding to death, and his friends bring a doctor. But the man says, wait a minute, I won't let you take the arrow out until I know the name of the man who shot it, until I know whether it was a crossbow or a longbow, until I know whether the shaft of the arrow was made of sal or neem wood. And it goes on and on and on, ad absurdum. And the Buddha compares that too to someone who will not embrace the practice of the Dhamma until certain metaphysical questions have been answered. Is there life after death? Are the mind and the body the same or different? Is the world infinite? Is it finite? Etc., etc. The Buddha's not sort of ridiculing those ideas. He's basically saying they're not relevant. In this particular case, that doesn't matter. You could argue till the cows come home, and you will probably never get to the solution to those problems. And in fact, it's quite rather prescient that 2,500 years later, we're still discussing the mind-body problem, for example, or whether there's life after death. These things have not been resolved. There's a sense, perhaps, that these are not topics that can be easily or readily settled, if at all. But that's beside the point too. The point is that the Dhamma concerns our actual life and responding to it in a way that may lead us to a greater sense of flourishing as a person and as a community, and diminishing whatever it is that stands in the way of our realizing what we could be. Now, I want to apply these images, to what I think fairly non-controversially is considered the Buddha's core teaching, and that is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Now, the Four Noble Truths, I think, are very usually presented as four propositions, four statements of fact, four things that all Buddhists believe. In fact, I was skimming through I was staying in a friend's house last night, and this morning he showed me the textbook for kids at school, The Buddhist Experience, for 10-year-olds. And I looked at the Four Noble Truths, and fair enough, there it went, four propositions of fact. Life is suffering, or there is suffering. The cause of suffering is craving, second truth. Third truth, there is a cessation of suffering through the cessation of craving. And the fourth truth, there is an eightfold path that leads to the cessation of craving, cessation of suffering. That is pretty much what you'll find in every presentation of Buddhism. And I think we've already run into a problem here. Essentially, it looks as though Buddhism is being reduced to a set of views and, about the nature of things, in the same way that the elephant is reduced to one particular bit of the whole creature and said to be this or that. And the Four Noble Truths, therefore, become four claims to describe what is the case. And a Buddhist is someone who believes that, who believes that craving is the origin of suffering, for example, whereas someone who's not a Buddhist would not necessarily believe that. So it becomes a kind of statement of faith that this is the template of views that you need to embrace in order to practice Buddhism. Whereas if you look at the text itself, the first sermon of the Buddha, where he introduces these ideas, although he starts by presenting these truths somewhat in that way, but I don't think exactly the same, he concludes the sermon by quite explicitly presenting these Four Noble Truths not as things to believe, but as things to do. In other words, not as beliefs, but as practices. And in fact, this is how he defines his awakening. We saw that in the first description, he's awoken to this conditioned arising. When we get to the first sermon, which was probably given a month or so after the awakening itself, we find him saying the following. He says, as long as my knowledge and vision was not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of these Four Noble Truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world. The 12 aspects of the Four Truths. Now, again, I think what is characteristic of much of the early Buddhist tradition is that there's a great reluctance to privilege a particular higher truth, something that subsequent traditions might call the unconditioned, or nibbana, or emptiness, or mind. The Buddha never mentions any of these terms at all. Instead, he sees his awakening to having been entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the Four Truths. The Buddha's teaching very often moves from singularity into complexity. I think it's a very pluralistic doctrine. But the important point here is that these 12 aspects of the Four Truths, which I'm not going to go into in great detail, describe the recognition, the performance, and the accomplishment of four tasks. And the first truth, dukkha, suffering, as a task is something we need to really know, to embrace, to recognize, to take on board. The First Noble Truth, therefore, is not making a claim that life is suffering, and you either believe that or not. And this becomes enormously complicated, because clearly life is not always suffering. Buddhists will go out of their way to insist that nobody can really be happy here unless they're a realized arhant. And it's a curious parallel. In Christianity, you have the problem of justifying suffering. If God is good and and is all good, then how come we have suffering in this world? This is an old potato in the theistic traditions. The Buddhists have the opposite problem. They say everything is suffering. Then how come some people are happy? And the usual Buddhist answer to this is, oh, well, they're not really happy. But I personally find that rather perverse. It's an odd thing to say. But what it shows, I think, is as soon as you adopt, you think of the first noble truth as life is suffering, you start going off onto the kinds of theological explanations and justifications for your holding that view. But if you think of it as a task, you don't have that problem at all. The Buddha's not claiming everything is suffering. He's saying no suffering. Really no suffering. When he describes what he means by suffering, he says birth, sickness, aging, death. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, being separated from what you like. And he's not telling you, you know, that this is the nature of reality and you can pay attention to that. He's saying, know this. That's all. Know this. And the practice we're doing today, the practice of paying mindful attention to our breath, our body, our sensations, what's happening, that is a practice of dukkha parinyaha, fully knowing dukkha. It's quite explicitly the first step in practicing the first noble truth. Know your condition. Know what's going on. Notice it. Of course, there's also experiences in our life that are very pleasant, very joyful, very fulfilling, very, very rewarding. But the Buddha's saying, if we really want to grow up, if we really want to be fully human, we need to pay attention to those things that we habitually ignore or avoid, particularly dukkha. We need somehow to have the courage and also the inner strength and stillness to be able to look ourselves and our lives and the world in the face, unflinchingly. That's where the practice begins. And that's basically what we're doing on these retreats. And what we notice, as I mentioned this morning, is that although that sounds easy enough, when you actually try to do it, very curiously, your whole body-mind system rebels. And you find yourself remembering your summer holidays 4 years ago with your Aunt Mary in Bognor Regis or something, which is completely irrelevant. And yet that's what the mind does when it's confronted with the task of just stopping and looking and seeing what's going on. Coming to terms with the fact that you're in this body and this got a slightly uncomfortable in the lower back, and you hurt yourself the other day in your ankle, so that's hurting too. And there's all of these rather slightly unformed, amorphous thoughts bubbling up and disappearing. A slight tremor of anxiety whenever you think of a certain person. In other words, it's really about focusing the lamp of our awareness in a still space on the nuts and bolts of being human. That's the practice of the first truth. And that leads, I think, organically to the practice of the second truth, which is let go of grasping, let go of craving, don't hang on, don't clutch, don't identify. Now that's very different from saying craving is the cause of suffering. I strongly suspect, and there is some philological evidence for this, that the doctrine craving is the origin of suffering is actually a rather later addition. I can't say that for sure, but I have a strong suspicion it might be. When you think of the second noble truth as a practice to let go of grasping, let go of craving, which is what the Buddha says, such is craving, it can be let go of. It has been let go of. This is a task that we can try and accomplish. Something to do, not something to believe. In other words, the Buddha's teaching is pragmatic, it's not dogmatic. It's prescriptive, it's not descriptive. All of these terms that are often mentioned nowadays. And this, of course, is very much in keeping with the kind of metaphors that I've been mentioning, of pulling out the arrow, of seeing the whole elephant, of correctly apprehending the snake. We're talking here about a living process in which we are intimately involved, and we're being given tools and ideas and practices whereby to actually help us accomplish these tasks. For me, the problem with craving is not that it causes suffering. Of course, sometimes it does. There's no dispute about that. But the real problem with craving is that it prevents us from really living. So that we get completely identified and caught up with our attachment to views and opinions and ideas, or attachment to our identity as a, in terms of our job, in terms of our family, in terms of our religion. It's a very opposite movement to that which the Buddha seems to be encouraging. It's a tightening up around something, perhaps for good reasons, in order to make us feel more secure and safe in this rather insecure and unsafe world. But whatever advantages that grasping and clinging might bring, it carries in its wake a great disadvantage, namely that we somehow freeze up the energies of our life. Whereas the Buddha seems to be suggesting that we need to find ways to let go of those graspings and clingings, not as an end in itself, but rather in order that the energies of life can flow more freely. So when the Buddha speaks about what happens when craving is let go of, he describes it as entering a stream, a sotapanna, sotapatti, entering a stream. Again, another metaphor. And once again, a metaphor that is profoundly about life. Stream, water, entering a stream. Engaging with the flow of events. Living with them as they arise and as they pass away. Not trying to reduce them or to constrain them into some fixed view or understanding. But really to participate in this flow. Now the letting go of craving, which is the second truth, leads to the third truth, which is moments when that craving stops. And that's nirvana, nibbana, the stopping of craving. Not something the Buddha suggests once you get there you'll never have it again. It'll be a pause, a glimpse, an opening, where you realize that you do not have to live your life dictated by the attachments and fears and hatreds and all the other Buddhist bad things that you are often caught up in. That by this dropping away, this letting go, leads you to moments in which that whole habit pattern somehow is no longer the defining drive of how you live. But it opens you up to enter a stream. And what is the stream? Well, the Buddha describes that very explicitly as the Eightfold Path. To enter the stream is to enter the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path is the fourth Noble Truth. So the four truths, when presented as tasks, follow one from the other. And they culminate in entering the path itself. And remember, when the Buddha speaks of the path, he doesn't speak of it just as a spiritual path. He speaks of it in terms of our entire humanity, the way we see things, think about things, speak, act, work, commit ourselves. And then he speaks about mindfulness and concentration. He's talking very much of a way of life. A way of life that engages us on every level. Both internally, in terms of our own inner reflections and meditations, and also externally, in terms of how we communicate with others, how we embody our values in the world, how we apply these things in terms of our workplace, in terms of gaining our livelihood. And that then becomes the framework within which we can then cultivate attention and mindfulness and awareness and so on. It's all very much ongoing. So, to me, the Four Noble Truths are, in a sense, like the snake, like the elephant, like life itself. And the practice is not concerned really with believing doctrines or dogmas, whether Buddhist or otherwise, but rather turning one's whole way of relating to oneself and the world around, turning it on its head, perhaps. I mean, the Buddha does say that his teaching is patisotagami. It goes against the flow. It goes against the current of habit. It goes against the current of belief and conditioning and opinion. It's about entering into the stream of being alive. And such a way of life is not reducible to beliefs, any more than an elephant is reducible to its trunk or its tail. And I feel that it's this kind of approach that enables us also to appreciate the Dhamma as being a bit like a snake. Something very vital, something very dynamic, but also we have to be careful. We could get it wrong. We could misapprehend it in some way. So that's what I would like to share with you this afternoon. It's now 3 o'clock. And I would suggest that we now go and do walking meditation until 3:30. And then we'll have a short sitting meditation, and then we'll conclude the afternoon with an open discussion. Thank you.